the Forest of Knights, where after Turin slew Beleg by mishap. Nigh was Tenubial to those evil places, but she entered not that dark region, and the Valar set a new hope in her heart, so that she pressed on once more. Page 21. Seldom was any of the cats slain indeed, for in those days they were mightier far in valor and in strength than they have been since those things befell that thou art soon to learn, mightier even than the tawny cats of the southern lands where the sun burns hot. No less, too, was their skill in climbing and in hiding, and their fleetness was that of an arrow. Yet were the free dogs of the northern woods marvelously valiant and knew no fear, and great enmity was between them. And some of those hounds were held in dread even by the greatest of the cats. None, however, did Tiburth fear, save only Huan, the lord of the hounds of Hisalome. So swift was Huan, then on a time he had fallen upon Tiburth as he hunted alone in the woods, and pursuing him had overtaken him and nigh rent the fur of his neck from him ere he was rescued by a host of orcs that heard his cries. Huan got him many hurts in that battle ere he won away, but the wounded pride of Tiburth lusted ever for his death. Great, therefore, was the good fortune that befell Tenubial in meeting with Huan in the woods. And this she did in a little glade nigh to the forest's borders, where the first grasslands begin that are nourished by the upper waters of the river Sirion. Seeing him, she was mortally afraid and turned to flee. But in two swift leaps Huan overtook her. Speaking softly the deep tongue of the lost elves, he bade her be not afeard. And wherefore, said he, do I see an elfin maiden, and one most fair, wandering thus nigh to the places of the Prince of Evil Heart? Page 22. What is thy thought, O Huan? Little counsel have I for thee, said he, save that thou goest with all speed back to Artenor and thy father's halls, and I will accompany thee all the way, until those lands be reached that the magic of Melian the Queen does encompass. That will I never do, said she, while Beren liveth here, forgotten of his friends. I thought that such would be thy answer, said he. But if thou wilt still go forward with thy mad quest, then no counsel have I for thee save a desperate and a perilous one. We must make now all speed towards the ill places of Tiburth's abiding that are yet far off. I will guide thee thither by the most secret ways, and when we are come there, thou must creep alone, if thou hast the heart, to the dwelling of that prince at an hour nigh noon, when he and most of his household lie drowsing upon the terraces before his gates. There thou mayst perchance discover, if fortune is very kind, whether Beren be indeed within that ill place, as thy mother said to thee. But lo, I will lie not far from the foot of the mount whereon Tiburth's hall is built. And thou must say to Tiburth, so soon as thou seest him, be Beren there or be he not, that thou hast stumbled upon Huan of the Dogs, lying sick of great wounds in a withered dale without his gates. Fear not overmuch, for herein wilt thou both do my pleasure, and further thine own desires, as well as may be. Nor do I think that when Tiburth hears thy tidings, thou wilt be in any peril thyself for a time. Only do thou not direct him to the place that I shall show to thee. Thou must offer to guide him thither thyself. Thus thou shalt get free again of his evil house, and shalt see what I contrive for the Prince of Cats. Then did Tenubial shudder at the thought of what lay before, but she said that this reed would she sooner take than to return home. And they set forth straightway by secret pathways through the woods, and by winding trails over the bleak and stony lands that lay beyond. At last, on a day at morn, they came to a wide dale, hollowed like a bowl among the rocks. Deep were its sides, but naught grew there save low bushes of scanty leaves and withered grass. This is the withered dale that I spake of, said Huan. Yonder is the cave where the great... Here the typescript version of the tale of Tenubial ends at the foot of the page. I think it is improbable that any more of this version was made. Change is made to names in the tale of Tenubial. 1. Manuscript version. Ilfiniol replaced Elfriniol. In the typescript text, the name is Ilfrin. See pages 201 to 2. Tinwelinto Tinwelent. In the opening passage of the tale, page 8, where Ausir and Vajana differ on the forms of Tinwelin's name, the manuscript is very confused, and it is impossible to understand the succeeding stages. Throughout the tale, as originally written, Vajana calls Tinwelin Tinto Elu, or Elu. But in the argument at the beginning, it is Ausir who calls him Tinto Elu, while Vajana calls him Tinto Elum. Tinto Elu is certainly an Elvish form, but it is corrected throughout the tale to the gnomish Tinwelent, while Ausir's Tinto Elu at the beginning is corrected to Tinwe Linto. At the third occurrence of Tinwe in the opening passage, the name as originally written was Linwe, see 1.130. In the tales of The Coming of the Elves and The Theft of Melko in Part 1, Elu is the name of the second lord of the Solosimpi chosen in Tinwelin's place, afterwards Olwe. But at both occurrences, 1.120, 1.41, this is a later addition, 1.130, note 5, 1.55. Many years later, Elu again became Thingol's name, Sindarin Elu Thingol, Quenya Elwe Singolo, in the Silmarillion. Gwendoling. As the tale was originally written, Gwendolyn was the name throughout. Gwendolyn is found in tales given in Part 1, emended from Tinriel, 1.106-7, 1.31. He was later changed throughout to the gnomish form, Gwendoling, found in the early gnomish dictionary, 1.273, itself changed later to Gwetheling, except in the mouth of Ausir, who uses the elvish form Gwendolyn, page 8. Dairon replaced Tifanto throughout. For the change of Tifanto, replaced by Mablung at the end of the tale, notes 12 to 14 above, see the commentary, page 59, and for the name Kapalan, preceding Tifanto, see note 9. Dor Lomin replaced Ariador, page 11. In the tale of The Coming of the Elves, it is said, 1.119, that Ariador was the name of Hisalome among men. For Dor Lomin to Hisalome, see 1.112. At subsequent occurrences in this tale, Ariador was not changed. Angband was originally twice written, and in one of these cases it was changed to Angamandi, in the other, page 35, allowed to stand. In all other instances, Angamandi was the form first written. In the manuscript version of the tale, Vajana does not make consistent use of gnomish or elvish forms. Thus, she says Tevildo, not Tifil, Angamande, Gwendoling, replaced Gwendolin, Tinwelent, replaced Tinto Elu. In the typescript version, on the other hand, Vajana says Tibirth, Angband, Melian, replaced Gwenethlin, Thingol, replaced Tinwelent. Hirolorn, the Queen of Trees, replaced Golosbrindi, the Queen of the Forest, page 18. Hirolorn replaced Golosbrindi at subsequent occurrences. Uinen replaced Onen, or possibly Unen. Egnor Borimion replaced Egnor Gorimion. In the tales previously given, the patronymic prefix is Go, 1.146, 1.155. Tinwelent replaced Tinfelon, page 35, the only case. Compare Tinto Elon, mentioned above under Tinwe Dinto. Ikulwarthen replaced Igulwarthen. 2. Typescript version. Tinuviel replaced Tinifiel in the title and at every occurrence until the passage corresponding to manuscript version, page 11, yet now did he see Tinuviel dancing in the twilight. There and subsequently the form typed was Tinuviel. Singoldo replaced Tinwe Linto, page 41. Melion replaced Gwenethlin at every occurrence until the passage corresponding to manuscript version, page 12, The Stateliness of Queen Gwendoling. There and subsequently the form typed was Melion. Thingol replaced Tinwelent at every occurrence until the passage corresponding to manuscript version, page 12, by winding paths to the abode of Tinwelent. There and subsequently the form typed was Thingol. For ignore replaced by barahir, see page 43. Commentary on The Tale of Tinuviel. Section 1, The Primary Narrative. In this section, I shall consider only the conduct of the main story, and leave for the moment such questions as the wider history implied in it, Tinwellin's people and his dwelling, or the geography of the lands that appear in the story. The story of Beren's coming upon Tinuviel in the moonlit glade in its earliest recorded form, pages 11 to 12, was never changed in its central image, and it should be noticed that the passage in the Silmarillion, page 165, is an extremely concentrated and exalted rendering of the scene. Many elements not mentioned there were never in fact lost. In a very late reworking of the passage in the Lay of Lathion, the hemlocks and the white moths still appear, and Dairon the minstrel is present when Beren comes to the glade. Footnote. Lay of Lathion, the long unfinished poem in rhyming couplets in which is told the story of Beren and Luthien Tinuviel, composed in 1925-31, but parts of it substantially rewritten many years later. End of footnote. But there are nonetheless the most remarkable differences. And the chief of these is, of course, that Beren was here no mortal man, but an elf, one of the Noldali, and the absolutely essential element of the story of Beren and Luthien is not present. It will be seen later, pages 71-72, 139, that this was not originally so, however. In the now lost, because erased, first form of the tale of Tinuviel, he had been a man. It is for this reason that I have said that the reading man in the manuscript, see page 33 and note 10, later changed to gnome, is a significant slip. Several years after the composition of the tale in the form in which we have it, he became a man again, though at that time, 1925-6, my father appears to have hesitated long on the matter of the elvish or mortal nature of Beren. In the tale there is necessarily a quite different reason for the hostility and distrust shown to Beren in Artenor, Doria, namely that the elves of the woodland thought of the gnomes of Dor Lomin as treacherous creatures, cruel and faithless, see below page 65. It seems clear that at this time the history of Beren and his father, Egnor, was only very sketchily devised. There is in any case no hint of the story of the outlaw band led by his father, and its betrayal by Gorlim the Unhappy, the Silmarillion, pages 162 and following, before the first form of the Lay of Lathion, where the story appears fully formed. The Lay was in being to rather beyond this point by the late summer of 1925. But an association of Beren's father, changed to Beren himself, with Urin, Hurin, as brother-in-arms, is mentioned in the typescript version of the tale, pages 44 to 45, according to the latest of the outlines for Gilfanon's tale, 1-240. Urin and Egnor marched with countless battalions against the forces of Melkor. In the old story, Tinuviel had no meetings with Beren before the day when he boldly accosted her at last, and it was at that very time that she led him to Tinwellen's cave. They were not lovers. Tinuviel knew nothing of Beren but that he was enamored of her dancing, and it seems that she brought him before her father as a matter of courtesy, a natural thing to do. The betrayal of Beren to Thingol by Dairon, the Silmarillion, page 166, therefore has no place in the old story. There is nothing to betray. And indeed it is not shown in the tale that Dairon knew anything whatsoever of Beren before Tinuviel led him into the cave, beyond having once seen his face in the moonlight. Despite these radical differences in the narrative structure, it is remarkable how many features of the scene in Tinwellen's hall, pages 12 to 13, when Beren stood before the king, endured, while all the inner significance was shifted and enlarged. To the beginning, go back, for instance. Beren's abashment and silence, Tinuviel's answering for him, the sudden rising of his courage and uttering of his desire without preamble or hesitation. But the tone is altogether lighter and less grave than it afterwards became. In the jeering laughter of Tinwellen, who treats the matter as a jest and Beren as a benighted fool, there is no hint of what is explicit in the later story. Thus he wrought the doom of Doriath and was ensnared within the curse of Mandos, the Silmarillion, page 167. The Silmarils are indeed famous, and they have a holy power, page 34. But the fate of the world is not bound up with them. The Silmarillion, page 67. Baron is an elf, if of a feared and distrusted people, and his request lacks the deepest dimension of outrage, and he and Tenuvial are not lovers. In this passage is the first mention of the Iron Crown of Melko, and the setting of the Silmarils in the crown. And here again is a detail that was never lost. Never did this crown leave his head. Compare the Silmarillion, page 81. That crown he never took from his head, though its weight became a deadly weariness. But from this point, Vaiana's story diverges in an altogether unexpected fashion from the later narrative. At no other place in the Lost Tales is the subsequent transformation more remarkable than in this. The precursor of the story of the capture of Beren and Felagund and their companions by Sauron the Necromancer, the imprisonment and death of all save Beren in the dungeons of Tol Ingalhoth, the Isle of Werewolves in the River Sirion, and the rescue of Beren and overthrow of Sauron by Lúthien and Huon. Most notably, what may be referred to as the Nargothrond element is entirely absent, and insofar as it already existed, had as yet made no contact with the story of Beren and Tenuvial. For Nargothrond, not yet so named at this period, see pages 81, 123 to 24. Beren has no ring of Felagund, he has no companions on his northward journey, and there is no relationship between, on the one hand, the story of his capture, his speech with Melko, and his dispatch to the house of Tevildo, and, on the other, the events of the later narrative whereby Beren and the band of elves out of Nargothrond found themselves in Sauron's dungeon. Indeed, all the complex background of legend, of battles and rivalries, oaths and alliances, out of which the story of Beren and Lúthien arises in the Silmarillion, is very largely absent. The Castle of the Cats is the Tower of Sauron on Tol Ingalhoth, but only in the sense that it occupies the same space in the narrative. Beyond this, there is no point in seeking even shadowy resemblances between the two establishments. The monstrous gormandizing cats, their kitchens and their sunning terraces, and their engagingly elvish feline names, Miaugion, Miaule, Meowita, all disappeared without trace. Did Tevildo? It would scarcely be true, I think, to say even that Sauron originated in a cat. In the next phase of the legends, the necromancer, Thu, has no feline attributes. On the other hand, it would be wrong to regard it as a simple matter of replacement, through stepping into the narrative place vacated by Tevildo, without any element of transformation of what was previously there. Tevildo's immediate successor is the Lord of Wolves, himself a werewolf, and he retains the Tevildo trait of hating Huon more than any other creature in the world. Tevildo was an evil fae in beast-like shape, page 29. And the battle between the two great beasts, the hound against the werewolf, originally the hound against the demon in feline form, was never lost. When the tale returns to Tenuvial in Arthanor, the situation is quite the reverse. For the story of her imprisonment in the house in Hirolorn and her escape from it never underwent any significant change. The passage in the Silmarillion, page 172, is indeed very brief, but its lack of detail is due to compression rather than to omission based on dissatisfaction. The Lay of Lathion, from which the prose account in the Silmarillion directly derives, is in this passage so close in point of narrative detail to the tale of Tenuvial as to be almost identical with it. It may be observed that in this part of the story, the earliest version had a strength that was diminished later, in that the duration of Tenuvial's imprisonment and her journey to Beren's rescue relates readily enough to that of Beren's captivity, which was intended by his captors to be unending. Whereas in the later story, there is a great deal of event and movement with the addition of Lúthien's captivity in Nargothrond to be fitted into the time when Beren was awaiting his death in the dungeon of the Necromancer. While the strong element of explanatory beast fable concerning cats and dogs was to be entirely eliminated, and Tevildo, Prince of Cats, replaced by the Necromancer, Huon nonetheless remained from it as the great Hound of Valinor. His encounter with Tenuvial in the woods, her inability to escape from him, and indeed his love for her from the moment of their meeting, suggested in the tale, page 23, explicit in the Silmarillion, page 173, were already present, though the context of their encounter and the motives of Huan were wholly different from the absence of the Nargothrond element, Felagund, Kelagorm, and Curathin. In the story of the defeat of Tevildo and the rescue of Beren, the germ of the later legend is clearly seen, though for the most part only in broad structural resemblances. It is curious to observe that the loud-speaking of Tenuvial sitting perched on the sill of the kitchen hatch in the castle of the cats, so that Beren might hear, is the precursor of her singing on the bridge of Torlin Gaurhoth, the song that Beren heard in his dungeon, the Silmarillion, page 174. Tevildo's intention to hand her over to Melko remained in Sauron's similar purpose, Ibid. The killing of the cat Oikoroi, page 28, is the germ of Huan's fight with Draugluin. The skin of Huan's dead opponent is put to the same use in either case, pages 30 to 31. The Silmarillion, pages 178 to 79. The battle of Tevildo and Huan was to become that of Huan and Wolf Sauron, and with essentially the same outcome. Huan released his enemy when he yielded the mastery of his dwelling. This last is very notable, the utterance by Tenuvial of the spell which bound stone to stone in the evil castle, page 29. Of course, when this was written, the castle of Tevildo was an adventitious feature in the story. It had no previous history. It was an evil place through and through. And the spell, deriving from Melko, that Tevildo was forced to reveal was the secret of Tevildo's own power over his creatures, as well as the magic that held the stones together. With the entry of Felagund into the developing legend and the elvish watchtower on Tol Sirion, Minas Tirith, the Silmarillion, pages 120, 155 to 56, captured by the necromancer, the spell is displaced. For it cannot be thought to be the work of Felagund, who built the fortress, since if it had been, he would have been able to pronounce it in the dungeon and bring the place down over their heads, a less evil way for them to die. This element in the legend remained, however, and is fully present in the Silmarillion, page 175, though since my father did not actually say there that Sauron told Huan and Luthien what the words were, but only that he yielded himself, one may miss the significance of what happened. And she said, "There everlastingly thy naked self shall endure the torment of his scorn, pierced by his eyes, unless thou yield to me the mastery of thy tower." Then Sauron yielded himself, and Luthien took the mastery of the isle and all that was there. Then Luthien stood upon the bridge and declared her power, and the spell was loosed that bound stone to stone, and the gates were thrown down, and the walls opened, and the pits laid bare. Here again the actual matter of the narrative is totally different in the early and late forms of the legend. In the Silmarillion, many thralls and captives came forth in wonder and dismay, for they had lain long in the darkness of Sauron. Whereas in the tale, the inmates who emerged from the shaken dwelling, other than Beren and the apparently inconsequent figure of the blind slave gnome Gimli, were a host of cats, reduced by the breaking of Tevildo's spell to puny size. If my father had used in the tale names other than Huan, Beren, and Tenuvial, and in the absence of all other knowledge, including that of authorship, it would not be easy to demonstrate from a simple comparison between this part of the tale and the story as told in the Silmarillion that the resemblances were more than superficial and accidental. A more minor narrative point may be noticed here. The typescript version would presumably have treated the fight of Huan and Tevildo somewhat differently. For in the manuscript, Tevildo and his companion can flee up great trees, page 28, whereas in the typescript, nothing grew in the withered dale, where Huan was to lie feigning sick, save low bushes of scanty leaves, page 48. In the remainder of the story, the congruence between early and late forms is far closer. The narrative structure in the tale may be summarized thus. Beren is attired for disguise in the fell of the dead cat Oikoroi. He and Tenuvial journey together to Angamandi. Tenuvial lays a spell of sleep on Karkaros, the wolf ward of Angamandi. They enter Angamandi. Beren slinks in his beast shape beneath the seat of Melko, and Tenuvial dances before Melko. All the host of Angamandi, and finally Melko himself, are cast into sleep, and Melko's iron crown rolls from his head. Tenuvial rouses Baron, who cuts a Silmaril from the crown, and the blade snaps. The sleepers stir, and Baron and Tenuvial flee back to the gates, but find Carcharus awake again. Carcharus bites off Baron's outthrust hand holding the Silmaril. Carcharus becomes mad with the pain of the Silmaril in his belly, for the Silmaril is a holy thing and sears evil flesh. Carcharus goes raging south to Artenor. Baron and Tenuvial return to Artenor. They go before Tynwellynt, and Baron declares that a Silmaril is in his hand. The hunting of the wolf takes place, and Mobluung the heavy-handed is one of the hunters. Baron is slain by Carcharus and is borne back to the cavern of Tynwellynt on a bier of boughs. Dying, he gives the Silmaril to Tynwellynt. Tenuvial follows Baron to Mundos, and Mundos permits them to return into the world. Changing the catskin of Oikoroi to the wolfskin of Draugluin, and altering some other names, this would do tolerably well as a précis of the story in the Silmarillion. But of course it is devised as a summary of similarities. There are major differences as well as a host of minor ones that do not appear in it. Again, most important is the absence of the Nargothrond element. When this combined with the Baron legend, it introduced Felagund as Baron's companion, Luthien's imprisonment in Nargothrond by Celegorm and Curufin, her escape with Huan, the Hound of Celegorm, and the attack on Baron and Luthien as they return from Tol Ingalrhoth by Celegorm and Curufin, now fleeing from Nargothrond, the Silmarillion, pages 173-4, 176-8. The narrative after the conclusion of the episode of The Thraldom of Beren is conducted quite differently in the old story, pages 30-31, in that here Huan is with Beren and Tenuvial. Tenuvial longs for her home, and Beren is grieved because he loves the life in the woods with the dogs, but he resolves the impasse by determining to obtain the Silmaril, and though Huan thinks their plan is folly, he gives them the fell of Oikoroi, clad in which Baron sets out with Tenuvial for Angamandi. In the Silmarillion, page 177, likewise, Baron, after long wandering in the woods with Luthien, though not with Huan, resolves to set forth again on the quest of the Silmaril. But Luthien's stance in the matter is different. You must choose, Baron, between these two, to relinquish the quest and your oath and seek a life of wandering upon the face of the earth, or to hold to your word and challenge the power of darkness upon its throne. But on either road I shall go with you, and our doom shall be alike. There then intervened the attack on Baron and Luthien by Celegorm and Curufin, when Huan, deserting his master, joined himself to them. They returned together to Doriath, and when they got there, Baron left Luthien sleeping and went back northwards by himself, riding Curufin's horse. He was overtaken on the edge of Unfoglith by Huan, bearing Luthien on his back, and bringing from Tol Ingalrhoth the skins of Draugluin and of Sauron's bat-messenger, Thuringwithil, of whom in the old story there is no trace. Attired in these, Baron and Luthien went to Angband. Huan is here their active counselor. The later legend is thus more full of movement and incidents in this part than is the tale of Tenuvial, though the final form was not achieved all at one stroke, as may be imagined. And in the Silmarillion form, this is the more marked from the fact that the account is a compression and a summary of the long lay of Lathion. Footnote. Compare Professor T. A. Shippey, The Road to Middle-Earth, 1982, page 193. In Baron and Luthien, as a whole, there is too much plot. The other side of that criticism is that on occasion, Tolkien has to be rather brisk with his own inventions. Celegorm wounds Baron, and the hound Huan turns on his master and pursues him. Returning, he brought to Luthien a herb out of the forest. With that leaf, she staunched Baron's wound, and by her arts and her love she healed him. The motif of the healing herb is a common one, the center, for instance, of the Breton Lay of Eliduc, turned into Conte by Marie de France. But in that, it occupies a whole scene, if not a whole poem. In the Silmarillion, it appears only to be dismissed in two lines, while Baron's wound is inflicted and healed in five. Repeatedly, one has this sense of summary. This sense is eminently justified. In the Lay of Lathion, the wounding and the healing with the herb occupy some 64 lines. Compare my foreword to the Silmarillion, page 8. End of footnote. In the tale of Tenuvial, the account of Beren's disguise is characteristically detailed. His instruction by Tenuvial in feline behavior, his heat and discomfort inside the skin. Tenuvial's disguise as a bat has, however, not yet emerged. And whereas in the Silmarillion, when confronted by Karkaroth, she cast back her foul raiment and commanded him to sleep, here she used once more the magical misty robe spun of her hair, the black strands of her dark veil she cast in his eyes, page 31. The indifference of Karkaroth to the false Oikoroi contrasts with Karkaroth's suspicion of the false Draugluin, of whose death he had heard tidings. In the old story, it is emphasized that no news of the discomfiture of Tevildo and the death of Oikoroi had yet reached Angamandi. The encounter of Tenuvial with Melko is given with far more detail than in the Silmarillion, here much compressed from its source. Notable is the phrase, page 32, "He leered horribly, for his dark mind pondered some evil." Forerunner of that in the Silmarillion, page 180, "Then Morgoth, looking upon her beauty, conceived in his thought an evil lust, and a design more dark than any that had yet come into his heart since he fled from Valinor." We are never told anything more explicit. Whether Melko's words to Tenuvial, "Who art thou that flittest about my halls like a bat?" and the description of her dancing, "noiseless as a bat," with a germ of her later bat disguise cannot be said, though it seems possible. The knife with which Beren cut the Silmaril from the Iron Crown has a quite different provenance in the tale of Tenuvial, being a kitchen knife that Beren took from Tevildo's castle, pages 29-33. In the Silmarillion, it was Angrist, the famous knife made by Telchar, which Beren took from Curufin. The sleepers of Angamandi are here disturbed by the sound of the snapping of the knife blade. In the Silmarillion, it is the shard flying from the snapped knife and striking Morgoth's cheek that makes him groan and stir. There is a minor difference in the accounts of the meeting with the wolf as Beren and Tenuvial fled out. In the Silmarillion, Luthien was spent, and she had not time nor strength to quell the wolf. In the tale, it seems that she might have done so if Beren had not been precipitate. Much more important, there appears here for the first time the conception of the holy power of the Silmarils that burns unhallowed flesh. Footnote. In an early note, there is a reference to the sacred Silmarils, 1-169, note 2. End of footnote. The escape of Tenuvial and Beren from Angamandi and their return to Artanor, pages 34-6, is treated quite differently in The Tale of Tenuvial. In the Silmarillion, pages 182-3, they were rescued by the eagles and set down on the borders of Doriath. And far more is made of the healing of Beren's wound, in which Huon plays a part. In the old story, Huon comes to them later, after their long southward flight on foot. In both accounts, there is a discussion between them as to whether or not they should return to her father's hall, but it is quite differently conducted. In the tale, it is she who persuades Beren to return. In the Silmarillion, it is Beren who persuades her. There is a curious feature in the story of the wolf hunt, pages 38-9, which may be considered here. See page 50, notes 12-15. At first, it was Tenuvial's brother who took part in the hunt with Tinwellant, Beren, and Huon, and his name is here Tifanto, which was the name throughout the tale before its replacement by Dairon. Footnote. The idea that Timpinen, Tinfang Warble, was the son of Tinwellant and sister of Tenuvial, see 1-106, note 1, had been abandoned. Tifanto, Dairon, is now named with Tinfang and Divara as the three most magic players of the elves, page 10. End of footnote. Subsequently, Tifanto, without passing through the stage of Dairon, was replaced by Mablung the Heavy-Handed, chief of the king's thanes, who here makes his first appearance as the fourth member of the hunt. But earlier in the tale, it is told that Tifanto, replaced by Dairon, leaving Artanor to seek Tenuvial, became utterly lost, and came never back to Elfenessa, page 21. And the loss of Tifanto, replaced by Dairon, is referred to again when Beren and Tenuvial return to Artanor, pages 36 to 7. Thus, on the one hand, Tifonto was lost, and it is a grief to Tenuvial on her return to learn of it, but on the other, he was present at the wolf hunt. Tifonto was then changed to Dairon throughout the tale, except in the story of the wolf hunt, where Tifonto was replaced by a new character, Moblung. This shows that Tifonto was removed from the hunt before the change of name to Dairon, but does not explain how, under the name Tifonto, he was both lost in the wilds and present at the hunt. Since there is nothing in the manuscript itself to explain this puzzle, I can only conclude that my father did in fact write at first that Tifonto was lost and never came back, and also that he took part in the wolf hunt. But observing this contradiction, he introduced Moblung in the latter role, and probably did this even before the tale was completed, since at the last appearance of Moblung his name was written thus, not emended from Tifonto. See note 15. It was subsequent to this that Tifonto was emended, wherever it still stood, to Dairon. In the tale, the hunt is differently managed from the story in the Silmarillion, where, incidentally, Beleg Strongbow was present. It is curious that all, including, as it appears, Hwan, save Beren, were asleep when Karkaros came on them, in Beren's Watch, page 39. In the Silmarillion, Hwan slew Karkaroth and was slain by him, whereas here, Karkaros met his death from the king's spear, and the boy Ausir tells at the end that Hwan lived on to find Beren again at the time of the great deeds of the Nauglofring, page 41. Of Hwan's destiny that he should not die until he encountered the mightiest wolf that would ever walk the world, and of his being permitted thrice only ere his death to speak with words, the Silmarillion, page 173, there is nothing here. The most remarkable feature of the tale of Tenuvial remains the fact that in its earliest extant form, Beren was an elf, and in this connection, very notable are the words of the boy at the end, page 40. Yet said Mondos to those twain, Lo, O elves, it is not to any life of perfect joy did I dismiss you, for such may no longer be found in all the world where sits Melko of the evil heart. And know ye that ye will become mortal even as men. And when ye fare hither again, it will be forever, unless the gods summon you indeed to Valinor. In the tale of the coming of the Valar and the building of Valinor, there occurs the following passage, 176, Commentary 190. Thither, that is to Mandor, in after days fared the elves of all the clans who were by ill hap slain with weapons, or did die of grief for those that were slain. And only so might the Eldar die, and then it was only for a while. There Mondos spake their doom, and there they waited in the darkness, dreaming of their past deeds, until such time as he appointed when they might again be born into their children, and go forth to laugh and sing again. The same idea occurs in the tale of the Music of the Ainur, 159. The peculiar dispensation of Mondos in the case of Beren and Tenuvial, as here conceived, is therefore that their whole natural destiny as elves was changed. Having died as elves might die, from wounds or from grief, they were not reborn as new beings, but returned from Mondos in their own persons, yet now mortal even as men. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 3. The Book of Lost Tales, Part 2. By J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing on page 60. The earliest eschatology is too unclear to allow of a satisfactory interpretation of this mortality, and the passage in The Building of Valinor on the Fates of Men, 177, is particularly hard to understand. See the commentary on it, 190 and following. But it seems possible that the words, even as men, in the address of Mondos to Beren and Tenuvial, were included to stress the finality of whatever second deaths they might undergo. Their departure would be as final as that of men. There would be no second return in their own persons, and no reincarnation. They will remain in Mondos, when ye fare hither again, it will be forever. unless they are summoned by the gods to dwell in Valinor. These last words should probably be related to the passage in The Building of Valinor concerning the fate of certain men, 177. Few are they, and happy indeed, for whom at a season doth Nornara, the herald of the gods, set up. Then ride they with him in chariots or upon good horses down into the vale of Valinor, and feast in the halls of Valmar, dwelling in the houses of the gods until the great end come. Section 2. Places and Peoples in the Tale of Tenuvial. To consider first what can be learned of the geography of the great lands from this tale, the early dictionary of the Gnomish language makes it clear that the meaning of Artanor was the land beyond, as it is interpreted in the text, page 9. Several passages in the Lost Tales cast light on this expression. In an outline for Gilfanan's Untold Tale, 1-240, the Noldali exiled from Valinor now fought for the first time with the orcs and captured the pass of the Bitter Hills. Thus they escaped from the Land of Shadows. They entered the forest of Artanor and the region of the Great Plains, which latter, I suggested, may be the forerunner of the later Talath Dirnan, the guarded plain of Nargothrond. The tale to follow Gilfanan's, according to the projected scheme, 1-241, was to be that of Tenuvial, and this outline begins, Baron son of Egnor wandered out of Dorlomin, that is, Hiselomer, see 1-112, into Artanor. In the present tale, it is said that Baron came through the terrors of the Iron Mountains until he reached the lands beyond, page 11, and also, page 21, that some of the dogs roamed the woods of Hiselome, or passing the mountainous places, fared even at times into the region of Artanor and the lands beyond and to the south. And finally, in The Tale of Turambar, page 72, there is a reference to the road over the dark hills of Hithlum into the great forests of the land beyond, where in those days Tinwelant, the hidden king, had his abode. It is quite clear, then, that Artanor, afterwards called Doriath, which appears in the title to the typescript text of the tale of Tenuvial, together with an earlier form, Dor Afro, page 41, lay in the original conception in much the same relation to Hiselome, the land of shadow, shadows, Dor Lomin, Ariador, as does Doriath to Hithlum, Hiselome, in the Silmarillion. To the south, and divided from it by a mountain range, the Iron Mountains, or Bitter Hills. In commenting on the tale of the theft of Melko and the darkening of Valinor, I have noticed, 1-158-9, that whereas in the Lost Tales Hiselome is declared to be beyond the Iron Mountains, it is also said in the tale of Turambar, page 77, that these mountains were so named from Angban, the Hells of Iron, which lay beneath their northernmost fastnesses, and that therefore there seems to be a contradictory usage of the term Iron Mountains within the Lost Tales, unless it can be supposed that these mountains were conceived as a continuous range, the southerly extension, the later Mountains of Shadow, forming the southern fence of Hiselome, while the northern peaks, being above Angband, gave the range its name. Now in the tale of Tenuvial, Baron, journeying north from Artanor, drew nigh to the lower hills and treeless lands that warned of the approach of the bleak Iron Mountains, page 14. These he had previously traversed, coming out of Hiselome. But now he followed the Iron Mountains till he drew nigh to the terrible regions of Melko's abode. This seems to support the suggestion that the mountains fencing Hiselome from the lands beyond were continuous with those above Angban. And we may compare the little primitive map, 181, where the mountain range F isolates Hiselome, G, see 1-112-135. The implication is that dim or black Hiselome had no defense against Melko. There appear now also the Mountains of Night, pages 20, 46-7, and it seems clear that the great pine woods of Tar Fuin, the Forest of Night, grew upon those heights, in the Silmarillion Dorthonion, Land of Pines, afterwards named Tar Nu Fuin. Dairon was lost there, but Tenuvial, though she passed near, did not enter that dark region. There is nothing to show that it was not placed then as it was later, to the east of Ered Wethrin, the Mountains of Shadow. It is also at least possible that the description in the manuscript version only, page 23, of Tinuviel on departing from Huon, leaving the shelter of the trees, and coming to a region of long grass, is a first intimation of the great plain of Ardgalan, called after its desolation Anfauglith and Dornufauglith, especially if this is related to the passage in the typescript version, telling of Tinuviel's meeting with Huon in a little glade nigh to the forest's borders where the first grasslands begin that are nourished by the upper waters of the river Sirion, page 47. After their escape from Angamandi, Huon found Beren and Tinuviel in that northward region of Artenor that was called afterward Nandumgorthin, the land of the dark idols, page 35. In the Gnomish dictionary, Nandumgorthin is defined as a land of dark forest east of Artenor, where on a wooded mountain were hidden idols sacrificed to by some evil tribes of renegade men. Dum, secret, not to be spoken. Dumgort, Dungort, an evil idol. In the Lay of the Children of Húrin, in alliterative verse, Túrin and his companion Flinding, later Gwyndor, fleeing after the death of Beleg Strongbow, came to this land. There the twain enfolded, phantom twilight, and dim mazes, dark, unholy, in Nandungorthin, where nameless gods have shrouded shrines, in shadows secret, more old than Morgoth, or the ancient lords, the golden gods of the guarded west. But the ghostly dwellers of that grey valley hindered nor hurt them, and they held their course with creeping flesh and quaking limb, yet laughter at whiles with lingering echo, as distant mockery of demon voices, there harsh and hollow in the hushed twilight, Flinding fancied fell unwholesome. There are, I believe, no other references to the gods of Nandumgorthin. In the poem, the land was placed west of Sirion, and finally as Nandungortheb, the Valley of Dreadful Death. It becomes in the Silmarillion, pages 81-121, a no-land between the Girdle of Melian and Ered Gorgoroth, the Mountains of Terror. But the description of it in the tale of Tinuviel as a northward region of Artenor clearly does not imply that it lay within the protective magic of Gwendoline, and it seems that this zone was originally less distinctly bounded and less extensive than the Girdle of Melian afterwards became. Probably Artenor was conceived at this time as a great region of forest, in the heart of which was Tinwellin's cavern, and only his immediate domain was protected by the power of the queen. Hidden was his dwelling from the vision and knowledge of Melko by the magics of Gwendoline the Fae. And she wove spells about the paths thereto, that none but the Eldar might tread them easily. And so was the king secured from all dangers, save it be treachery alone, page 9. It seems also that her protection was originally by no means so complete and so mighty a wall of defense as it became. Thus, although orcs and wolves disappeared when Beren and Tinuviel stepped within the circle of Gwendoline's magic that hid the paths from evil things and kept harm from the regions of the wood elves, page 35, the fear is expressed that even if Beren and Tinuviel reached the cavern of King Tinwellant, they would but draw the chase behind them thither, page 34, and Tinwellant's people feared that Melko would upraise his strength and come utterly to crush them, and Gwendoline's magic have not the strength to withhold the numbers of the orcs, page 36. The picture of Menegroth beside Isgalduin, accessible only by the bridge, the Silmarillion, pages 92-3, goes back to the beginning, though neither cave nor river are named in the tale. But, as will be seen more emphatically in later tales in this book, Tinwellant, the wood fairy in his cabin, had a long elevation before him to become ultimately Thingol of the Thousand Caves, the fairest dwelling of any king that has ever been east of the sea. In the beginning, Tinwellant's dwelling was not a subterranean city full of marvels, silver fountains falling into basins of marble and pillars carved like trees, but a rugged cave. And if in the typescript version the cave comes to be vaulted immeasurable, it is still illuminated only by the dim and flickering light of torches, pages 43-46. There have been earlier references in the Lost Tales to Tinwellant and the place of his dwelling. In a passage added to but then rejected from the tale of the Chaining of Melko, 1106, note 1, it is said that he was lost in Hisilome and met Wendelin there. Loving her, he was content to leave his folk and dance forever in the shadows. In The Coming of the Elves, 1115, Tinwe abode not long with his people, and yet 'tis said lives still lord of the scattered elves of Hisilome. And in the same tale, 1118-19, the lost elves were still there long after when men were shut in Hisilome by Melko, and men called them the Shadow Folk and feared them. But in the tale of Tinuviel, the conception has changed. Tinwellant is now a king ruling not in Hisilome, but in Artenor. Footnote. In the outlines for Gilfanon's tale, the Shadow Folk of Hisilome have ceased to be elves and become fays, whose origin is unknown. 1.237.239. End of footnote. It is not said where it was that he came upon Gwendolyn. In the account, manuscript version only, see pages 9.42, of Tinwellant's people, there is mention of elves who remained in the dark. And this obviously refers to elves who never left the waters of awakening. Of course, those who were lost on the march from Palisor also never left the dark, that is, they never came to the light of the trees. But the distinction made in this sentence is not between the darkness and the light, but between those who remained and those who set out. On the emergence of this idea in the course of the writing of the Lost Tales, see 1.234. Of Tinwellant's subjects, the most were Ilkorindi, and they must be those who had been lost upon the march from Palisor, earlier the lost elves of Hisilome. Here, a major difference in essential conception between the old legend and the form in the Silmarillion is apparent. These Ilkorindi of Tinwellant's following, eerie and strange beings whose dark songs and chantings faded in the wooded places or echoed in deep caves, are described in terms applicable to the wild Avari, the unwilling of the Silmarillion. But they are, of course, actually the precursors of the grey elves of Doriath. The term Eldar is here equivalent to elves. All the Eldar, both those who remained in the dark or had been lost upon the march from Palisor, and is not restricted to those who made, or at least embarked on, the great journey. All were Ilkorindi, dark elves, if they never passed over the sea. The later significance of the great journey in conferring Eldarin status was an aspect of the elevation of the grey elves of Beleriand, bringing about a distinction of the utmost importance within the category of the Moriquendi, or elves of the darkness. The Avari, who were not Eldar, and the Umanyar, the Eldar who were not of Aman. See the table, The Sundering of the Elves, given in the Silmarillion. Thus, Lost Tales, Eldar of Kor, of the Great Lands, the Darkness, Ilkorindi. Silmarillion, Avari, Eldar of the Great Journey, of Arman, of Middle-earth, Umanyar. But among Tinwellant's subjects, there were also Noldali, gnomes. This matter is somewhat obscure, but at least it may be observed that the manuscript and typescript versions of the Tale of Tinuviel do not envisage precisely the same situation. The manuscript text is perhaps not perfectly explicit on the subject, but it is said, page 9, that of Tinwellant's subjects, the most were Ilkorindi, and that before the rising of the sun, already were their numbers mingled with a many wandering gnomes. Yet Dairon fled from the apparition of Beren in the forest, because all the elves of the woodland thought of the gnomes of Dor Lomin as treacherous creatures, cruel and faithless, page 11. And dread and suspicion was between the Eldar and those of their kindred that had tasted the slavery of Melko, and in this did the evil deeds of the gnomes at the Haven of the Swans revenge itself, page 11. The hostility of the elves of Artenor to gnomes was then specifically a hostility to the gnomes of Hisilome, Dor Lomin, who were suspected of being under the will of Melko, and this is probably a foreshadowing of the suspicion and rejection of elves escaped from Angband described in the Silmarillion, page 156. In the manuscript it is said, page 9, that all the elves of the great lands, those who remained in Polisor, those who were lost on the march, and the Noldali returned from Valinor, fell beneath the power of Melko, though many escaped and wandered in the wild. And as the manuscript text was first written, see page 11 and note 3, Beren was son of a thrall of Melko's, that labored in the darker places in the north of Hisalome. This conception seems reasonably clear, so far as it goes. In the typescript version, it is expressly stated that there were gnomes in Tinwellen's service, page 43. The bridge over the forest river leading to Tinwellen's door was hung by them. It is not now stated that all the elves of the great lands fell beneath Melko. Rather, there are named several centers of resistance to his power, in addition to Tinwellen, Thingol, in Artenor, Turgon of Gondolin, the sons of Feanor, and Egnor of Hisalome, Beren's father. One of the chiefest foes of Melko, in all the kin of the gnomes that still were free, page 44. Presumably this led to the exclusion in the typescript of the passage telling that the woodland elves thought of the gnomes of Dor Lomin as treacherous and faithless, see page 43, while that concerning the distrust of those who had been Melko's slaves was retained. The passage concerning Hisalome, where dwelt men and thrall Noldali labored and few free Eldar went, page 10, was also retained. But Hisalome, in Beren's wish that he had never strayed out of it, becomes the wild free places of Hisalome, pages 17-45. This leads to an altogether baffling question, that of the references to the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, and several of the passages just cited bear on it. The story of the travail of the Noldali and the coming of mankind, that was to have been told by Gilfarnon, but which after its opening pages most unhappily never got beyond the stage of outline projections, was to be followed by that of Beren and Tenuvial, see 1-241. After the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, there is mention of the thraldom of the Noldali, the mines of Melko, the spell of bottomless dread, the shutting of men in Hisalome, and then Beren, son of Egnor, wandered out of Dor Lomin into Artenor. In the Silmarillion, the deeds of Beren and Luthien preceded the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. Now, in the tale of Tenuvial, there is a reference in both versions to the thrall Noldali, who labored in Hisalome and of men dwelling there. And as the passage introducing Beren was first written in the manuscript, his father was one of these slaves. It is said, again in both versions, that neither Tinwellen nor the most part of his people went to the battle, but that his lordship was greatly increased by fugitives from it, page 9. And to the following statement that his dwelling was hidden by the magic of Gwendoling Melian, the typescript adds the word thereafter, page 43, that is, after the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. In the changed passage in the typescript referring to Egnor, he is one of the chiefest foes of Melko in all the kin of the gnomes that still were free. All this seems to allow of only one conclusion. The events of the tale of Tinuvial took place after the great battle. And this seems to be clinched by the express statement in the typescript, where the manuscript, page 15, says that Melko sought ever to destroy the friendship and intercourse of elves and men. The second version adds, page 44, lest they forget the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, and once more arise in wrath against him. It is very odd, therefore, that the Arne should say at the beginning, in the manuscript only, page 10, and see page 43, that she will tell of things that happened in the halls of Tinwellent after the arising of the sun, indeed, but long ere the unforgotten Battle of Unnumbered Tears. This, in any case, seems to imply a much longer period between the two events than is suggested in the outlines for Gilfarnon's tale. See 1-242. This is repeated later, page 17. It was a thing unthought that any elf should fare untended to the halls of Melko, even in those earlier days before the Battle of Tears, when Melko's power had not grown great. But it is stranger still that this second sentence is retained in the typescript, page 45. The typescript version has thus two inescapably contradictory statements. Melko sought ever to destroy the friendship and intercourse of elves and men, lest they forget the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, page 44. Little love was there between the woodland elves and the folk of Ungband, even in those days before the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, page 45. Such a radical contradiction within a single text is in the highest degree unusual, perhaps unique, in all the writings concerned with the First Age. But I can see no way to explain it, other than simply accepting it as a radical contradiction. Nor indeed can I explain those statements in both versions that the events of the tale took place before the battle, since virtually all indications point to the contrary. Footnote: in the tale of Turambar, the story of Beren and Tenuviel clearly and necessarily took place before the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, pages 71 to 2, 140. End of footnote. Section 3, Miscellaneous Matters. 1. Morgoth. Beren addresses Melko as Most Mighty Belcha Morgoth, which are said to be his names among the gnomes, page 44. In the gnomish dictionary, Belcha is given as the gnomish form corresponding to Melko, see 1-260, but Morgoth is not found in it. Indeed, this is the first and only appearance of the name in the Lost Tale. The element Goth is given in the gnomish dictionary with the meaning war, strife. But if Morgoth meant at this period black strife, it is perhaps strange that Beren should use it in a flattering speech. A name list made in the 1930s explains Morgoth as formed from his orc name Goth, lord or master, with more, dark or black, prefixed. But it seems very doubtful that this etymology is valid for the earlier period. This name list explains Gothmog, captain of Balrogs, as containing the same orc element, voice of Goth, Morgoth. But in the name list to the tale of the Fall of Gondolin, page 216, the name Gothmog is said to mean strife and hatred. Mog, detest, hate, appears in the gnomish dictionary, which supports the interpretation of Morgoth in the present tale as black strife. Footnote: nothing is said in any text to suggest that Gothmog played such a role in relation to Morgoth as the interpretation voice of Goth implies. But nor is anything said to contradict it, and he was from the beginning an important figure in the evil realm, and in a special relation to Melko, see page 216. There is perhaps a reminiscence of the voice of Morgoth in the mouth of Sauron, the black Numenorean, who was the lieutenant of Barad-dûr, the return of the king, 5:10. End of footnote. 2. Orcs and Balrogs. Despite the reference to the wandering bands of the goblins and the orcs, page 14, retained in the typescript version, the terms are certainly synonymous in the tale of Turambar. The orcs are described in the present tale, Ibid, as foul broodings of Melko. In the second version, page 44, wolf rider orcs appear. Balrogs mentioned in the tale, page 15, have appeared in one of the outlines for Gilfanan's tale, 1-241. But they had already played an important part in the earliest of the Lost Tales, that of the Fall of Gondolin, see pages 212 to 13. 3. Tenuviel's Lengthening Spell. Of the longest things named in this spell, pages 19 to 20, 46, 2. The Sword of Nann and the Neck of Gilim the Giant seem now lost beyond recall, though they survived into the spell in the Lay of Lathion, where the Sword of Nann is itself named Glend, and Gilim is called the Giant of Eruman. Gilim in the gnomish dictionary means winter, see 1-260, entry Melko. Which does not seem particularly appropriate, though a jotting very difficult to read in the little notebook used for memoranda in connection with the Lost Tales, see 1-171, seems to say that Nann was a giant of summer of the south, and that he was like an elm. The Indravangs, Indrafangs in the typescript, are the Longbeards. This is said in the gnomish dictionary to be a special name of the Naugloth or dwarves. See further the tale of the Naugloffring, page 247. Carcharas, K-A-R-K-A-R-A-S, Carcharas in the typescript, C-A-R-C-A-R-A-S, Knife Fang is named in the spell since he was originally conceived as the father of wolves who guarded the gates of Angamandi in those days and long had done so, page 21. In the Silmarillion, page 180, he has a different history. chosen by Morgoth from among the whelps of the race of Draugluin, and reared to be the death of Huan. He was set before the gates of Angband in that very time. In the Silmarillion, Ibid, Carcharoth is rendered the Red Maw, and this expression is used in the text of the tale, page 34. Both hand and jewel Carcharoth bit off and took into his red maw. Glorund is the name of the dragon in the tale of Turambar, Glaurung in the Silmarillion. In the tale of the chaining of Melko, there is no suggestion that Tulkas had any part in the making of the chain, there in the form Ungaino, 1-100. 4. The influence of the Valar. There is frequent suggestion that the Valar in some way exercised a direct influence over the minds and hearts of the distant elves in the great lands. Thus it is said, page 15, that the Valar must have inspired Beren's ingenious speech to Melko, and while this may be no more than a rhetorical flourish, it is clear that Tenubial's dream of Beren is meant to be accepted as a dream of the Valar, page 19. Again, the Valar set a new hope in her heart, page 47. And later in Vaiana's tale, the Valar are seen as active fates, guiding the destinies of the characters. So the Valar brought Huan to find Beren and Tenubial in Nandum Gorfin, page 35. And Tenubial says to Tin Welant that the Valar alone saved Beren from a bitter death, page 37. 2. Turambar and the Forloke. The tale of Turambar, like that of Tenubial, is a manuscript written in ink over a wholly erased original in pencil. But it seems certain that the extant form of Turambar preceded the extant form of Tenubial. This can be deduced in more ways than one, but the order of composition is clearly exemplified in the forms of the name of the king of the woodland elves, Thingol. Throughout the manuscript of Turambar, he was originally Tintoglin, and this appears also in the tale of the coming of the elves, where it was changed to Tinwelant, 1-115-131. A note on the manuscript at the beginning of the tale says, Tintoglin's name must be altered throughout to Elon or Tinthelon, equals Quenya Elu. But the note was struck out, and all through the tale, Tintoglin was in fact changed to Tinwelant. Now, in the tale of Tenubial, the king's name was first given as Elu, or Tinto Elu, and one says Tinthelon, pages 50 to 51. Subsequently, it was changed throughout to Tinwelan. It is clear that the direction to change Tintoglin to Elon or Tinthelon, equals Quenya Elu, belongs to the time when the tale of Tenubial was being or had been rewritten, and that the extant tale of Turambar already existed. There is also the fact that the rewritten Tenubial was followed, at the same time of composition, by the first form of the interlude in which Gilfanan appears, see 1203, whereas at the beginning of Turambar there is a reference to Ailios, who was replaced by Gilfanan, concluding the previous tale. On the different arrangement of the tale-telling at this point that my father subsequently introduced but failed to carry through, see 1229-30. According to the earlier arrangement, Ailios told his tale on the first night of the feast of Turohalme, or the log-drawing, and Eltas followed with the tale of Turambar on the second. There is evidence that the tale of Turambar was in existence at any rate by the middle of 1919. Humphrey Carpenter discovered a passage written on a scrap of proof for the Oxford English Dictionary, in an early alphabet of my father's devising, and transliterating it, he found it to be from this tale, not far from the beginning. He has told me that my father was using this version of the alphabet of Rumil about June 1919, see Biography, page 100. When then Ailios had spoken his fill, the time for the lighting of candles was at hand. And so came the first day of Turuhalme to an end. But on the second night, Ailios was not there, and being asked by Lindo, one Eltas began a tale and said,